Don't forget that an easy way to support Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is through Patreon. Patreon.com/Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories puts you into a reservoir of extra content from the show. Yeah, there's tons of stuff there, from extra episodes where Murdoch and I talk about playlists or top five lists that we've made, all the way to outtakes, extra moments from the show, especially recently. I know, you may not think we edit, but we do. We do a lot of editing on the show, and sometimes there's big chunks of our conversations that get cut out for time, and you can have them. They're up there on the Patreon, along with weekly newsletters where Murdoch and I run down music we're listening to, things going on in our personal lives, headlines from the rock and roll world, a whole lot of stuff. You can get involved and make it really easy to get in touch with us. There's a messaging system within Patreon that makes it very easy to communicate directly with both Murdoch and I. So if you want to do all that, if you want to be a little closer to the show and have a lot more content for your listening pleasure throughout the week, then go ahead. Patreon.com/Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories. $5 a month, $10 a month gets you two different levels of access, or just, you know, create a free account and see what you're missing. You can do that as well. It's patreon.com/Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Don't go to sleep, mother. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Get in touch with us by sending us an email. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. This one says, hey guys, have you ever thought about doing a Wrecking Crew episode? All the behind-the-scenes stuff would be cool to hear about. Signed, John. Fun side note about John, real quickly. He signed with his business signature. He's an audio engineer.
Oh, how kick-ass. Like, so excited that, one, you're listening, because, wow, that's cool. Thanks for writing the show, John.
I mean, shouts to all the musicians and music-adjacent people who are into this show. That feels like a big compliment to me, because usually people who are music-adjacent are knowledgeable about music, so sometimes they don't listen to stuff like this because they feel like they already know it. So I'm really glad you're along on this journey, and shouts to our other folks, like our guitar makers and our bass makers and all those people who we know listen to the show.
This is the DNA of rock and roll, of the American songbook, of everything, and some people may have no freaking idea.
So the question is, can we do a Wrecking Crew episode? And the answer is yes. That's the short answer. We both absolutely love the Wrecking Crew.
There's a great documentary if you want to go. It's not superbly done, but it's enough for a primer if you have no idea or whatever. But it's such a big piece of music history. The songs alone are probably what's most important.
Well, and there's just a lot of angles to cover with this. It's a little overwhelming. I mean, I think part of the reason we've put it off is just, it's like, where do you start? You've got big solo success stories, right? Like, you got Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell. You've got the hundreds of songs, like you just mentioned. You've got landmark albums that they were a part of. And you've got some controversy around what they performed on and what they were a part of.
And, you know, people did make money, but this Wrecking Crew folks, man, they didn't get album royalties. And they were playing on records that were enormous.
And what I think gets lost here is the number of folks associated with this loose collective. So that only gives us like more to choose from, right? Because it's not like it's just a five-piece band. It's a whole bunch of people who floated in and out of the scene. So here's what I thought we'd do. I think we use John's inquiry as a jumping off point. And I think we might end up finding ourselves in a series of episodes, maybe not back to back to back, but over the coming months and year, where we may come back to this letter and talk a little bit more about another member of the Wrecking Crew and just use that moniker as the commonality that brings everything together. Do you think that's workable?
Yeah, and there's so much to cover. I'm glad that John wrote the letter, because we get to talk about this with everybody, because it's fun.
So, John, here is our first of what might be many attempts over an unspecified amount of time to go deep on this entity that did so much to shape popular music today. So let's talk about the Wrecking Crew.
Right. So first, let's do a primer for everybody that's uninitiated. Does that sound
good, that's great. You want to do the honors? Kick us off?
Yeah. So from 30,000 feet, the simplest way to get there is the Wrecking Crew was used to refer to a loose collective of session musicians in Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s who were used as players on a large amount of what would be the most significant songs and records to come out of the United States.
Okay, so you say significant. Don't just say significant. Give us examples. What do you mean?
Without going into the entire list, which we're going to end up doing, Pet Sounds, Good Vibrations, and The Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man.
Okay, you're right about those, you know, but...
There's a couple, right?
Yes, but you just picked some of the more controversial ones. I said controversy earlier, and this is the idea that they were a ghost band. So one thing, mm-hmm. this is not what we're going to get into today, but one thing that you hear about the Wrecking Crew is that they were the band actually playing on a lot of records where you think it's someone else. Not like in a way that is necessarily dishonest, but like they actually play a lot of the instruments on Pet Sounds. It's not the Beach Boys. Like Paul Revere and the Raiders, it's not even really like those guys weren't playing the instruments on the record. It was the Wrecking Crew. Like there's just a lot of examples of that. I think the Association's another one of those bands that gets thrown in there. Don't quote me on that. This is like a ghostwriter. So, you know, like if you have someone who is writing your book for you, but you get to put your name on it, there was a little bit of that happened with the Wrecking Crew. But they were sometimes just the backing band for people, right?
That's correct, yeah. By the way, you can see the Association in the Monterey Pop Festival, like see their performance, and it's like they're an actual band that sounds good, but seems to be playing everything fast because I think they got into whatever David Crosby was smoking before he performed. Anyway, so they were a backing band for people. So like Cher and frickin' Sinatra. And the Wrecking Crew are the musicians that made the Phil Spector wall of sound.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the more notable things.
Right. So if people aren't familiar with River Deep Mountain High, which should have been an enormous hit, you're familiar with You've Lost That Love and Feeling and that enormously beautiful music that sits behind the Righteous Brothers.
So if I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, okay, these people were a loose collective. They weren't really a real group. They just walked around calling themselves the Wrecking Crew. No. Okay.
Nah,
to be clear,
didn't do that either.
They did not do that. There are varied accounts of what they might have called themselves at the time. I think there were different iterations of them that had some sort of fun names they used, but they really aren't known by a name or really even known to have existed to the extent that they did until 1990. Yeah. This is when it enters the lexicon, right? One of the members, a drummer named Hal Blaine, wrote a memoir and explained all of the connections that we're outlaying right here.
Yeah, and Hal, it was so important that he did this because this existed in other places.
Right, this is another thing we forget, because when we talk about the Wrecking Crew, we're thinking L.A. Wrecking Crew, but there's sort of a Wrecking Crew for other places.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's where you start to think about in Nashville, there's the Nashville A-Team, there's the Funk Brothers in Detroit.
Oh, yeah. They did Motown stuff, right?
And yeah, and then Booker T and the MGs in Memphis. And then there's the Muscle Shoals,
right.
You know, that
right.
studio and the people that played there. And this is just the Los Angeles version, but they did play on a disproportionate amount of hits versus everybody else.
Yeah, they get special notice because of how much stuff they touched. And to hear Hal Blaine tell it, I also like this detail. He'll say that they get called the Wrecking Crew first as something that is supposed to be derogatory. It is older musicians saying that they're coming in and wrecking things. You know what I mean? Like the like Gen Z, you know? Like they're just coming in and they're rebels who are wearing blue jeans. They're not dressing up for sessions. They're not serious musicians. And so they call them the Wrecking Crew.
And you mentioned Hal Blaine, who's a famous guy, who's a drummer, but he is not the Wrecking Crew drummer you are interested in talking about on this episode for John's Letter.
Correct. I mean, Hal Blaine's great. We will probably talk about Hal Blaine on this show at some point. We're definitely going to quote him even later in this episode. But for this first attempt at telling a Wrecking Crew story, I want to examine an idea of moments of monumental history that these folks were a part of and how these actual moments, when they were in them, these musicians had no idea the significance of what they were creating.
Yeah.
And I think a great way to illustrate that concept is to tell the story of a guy who is also, like you said, a drummer named Earl Palmer. But I want to start before we talk about Earl and ask you a question. Have you ever been a fill-in? Have you ever gotten a last-minute call to step into something?
Yeah, but it was never something to where someone was like, oh, that's great. He's there. It was like, yeah, that's not the person we ordered. That's not the expectant person or human that's supposed to be standing there. Or in a lot of cases, that looks like a guy. That's not like the girl that's supposed to be doing this at all.
And I didn't even think about this until I just asked you the question. But this is actually how we met, sort of, because you were called in to fill in. I was running a department at a radio station, and you had worked there before. And somebody said, hey, you should call this guy while you're looking to hire, and he could come in and fill in. And then when I met you, I was like, I'm not hiring anybody else. This guy's the best.
It's so crazy that, like, that's really the fill-in thing. That's like the best fill-in thing ever. And you know where I was, right?
Yeah, you were about to go back to school, right?
I was in an office filling out a FAFSA, and I noticed and I saw the phone number, and I was like, somebody's quitting. Somebody's quitting.
He got called up. Well, yeah, I forgot about that. I had a funny instance that happened to me.
I got called up. What a great fill-in. Thanks, yeah, Brian, no, for making
look,
it
look
happen.
At, look at what happened. Look at what came out of that phone call in the FAFSA line.
This.
And less student debt. So I had a really funny story happen to me a couple years ago. So I was in this professional trade organization, and we did a it was for the advertising industry in our town, and we did an award ceremony every year. And yeah. One year I got some comedians that I think you probably know too, some local guys who are really funny, to be the host. I convinced this whole committee. I got on the committee to help them structure this thing and put it together. And I convinced them that we needed hosts and that our hosts should be these comedians, and they were terrible. It didn't work right. It wasn't that they were bad, and it wasn't that the audience was bad. It was just the wrong mix. And so the next year, the joke became, well, you have to do it because your suggestion was so bad last year. And I have obviously a lot of background hosting, so it was kind of, sure, sort of an obvious thing, right? And so I hosted this award show for several years after that because it became very easy. I was on the committee, and people would go, well, why don't you just do it? Because you're a known quantity. So fast forward 2 or 3 years, I've done this. I've been the repeat host over and over for this event. So we finally, planning time comes around, and I say, you know, how about I don't do it this year? How about we hire somebody else? So we actually hired someone who I will remain nameless because of what happened in this story, but it's somebody that you and I both know. And we hired this person. And so night of the event, I am like on cloud nine because I don't have to do anything because I can just hang out with my friends. So a bunch of friends show up. I don't know why you're not there, but our mutual friend Greg, a bunch of other people, they all show up. We're hanging out. We're eating. It's great. And all of a sudden, one of my co-organizers comes ashen white, grabs me by the arm. We're supposed to go on stage with the awards with this host in 20 minutes. And she goes, I just called the host, and the host had the wrong night and is not available. And we have 20 minutes. I need you to host again. So I've had no prep, no jokes, no. And this is like not just reading a script. It's hosting the event. So you got vamping, yeah, doing comedy. Like, that's the whole thing. Well, the theme was high school homecoming. It was all themed to be like a high school homecoming dance. And so I was like, lucky for you, I have a lot of really embarrassing stories from high school. And so I then, with about 20 minutes of notice, got up and had to host this event. And honestly, I think it was the best I ever did, because it was like just being called in at the last minute, getting to tell a bunch of funny, embarrassing stories. And the expectations were really low because all the people who hired me knew that I only had 20 minutes to prep.
Yeah, yeah. You had less time than Joe Coy did, but you killed it. Was that this year? Was that this year?
Was this story with me this year? No, yeah. It was a couple years ago.
Okay. I didn't even know that happened, because I've never been to that event.
So I bring this up, and not to tell a great story, a story that makes me look good. I bring this up because the story I want to get to involves this idea of being unwittingly in the right place at the right time and being called in to do something. But before we get to that, like I said, I want to talk about this one particular member of the Wrecking Crew. So let's talk about Earl Palmer.
Yeah. And the best anecdote, in this research to capture this guy comes from very late in his career. He dies in 2008, but in 96, right, and when the 90s are totally kick-ass, the guys in frickin' Cracker ask Earl Palmer to be in their video for their song "I Hate My Generation." That's in the show notes.
And I can't remember. Do you like Cracker?
So, you know, I have another Brian in my life, uh-huh, and his favorite band is Cracker.
Really?
Yes. And Cracker is not my favorite band.
I will say there are.
I'll just go there.
There are parts of Cracker's discography that are very good, even some of the later stuff. And I saw a version of Cracker early before I was back here in this town. So it was like 15, 20 years ago. And that was very cool. I've not seen them in a long time, but I would, if they're, I don't even know if they're performing anymore. But they have even a record. There's like the 2009 record. It's called like In the Land of Milk and Honey or something. That's a great record. Yeah. It might have Adam Duritz on it, so I might be biased, but it's a great record. And of course, the Counting Crows and Cracker, they're buddies. So David Lowery from that band, from Cracker, has told this really good story about getting Palmer. And I the idea here is about, I hate my generation. They don't have the classic feel of the generation before us, right? So it's mid-90s slacker rock, saying like, oh man, we don't have it like the guys in the 60s did, right? And so they go and they get this. I mean, you wouldn't know Earl Palmer to see him. So it's very much an in-joke where they're like, we're going to get this guy to come and play drums in the back of this video. And the song is pretty rocking. If you've never heard that song, it kicks pretty hard. And so Lowery says that he asks him, hey, like, do you think you'll be able to keep up with this? And the story goes that Earl Palmer just looks at him and goes, I invented this shit.
And he's not wrong.
He's not. He literally invented it.
No, he's not wrong. In and out of his Wrecking Crew days, Earl is all over popular music. To illustrate this, I'm going to give you that list because it's always fun, you know, on our show to like, here's somebody worked with all these people. And so here's people. And we featured some of these people on the show too before. So Sinatra, Ricky Nelson, Bobby V, Richie Valens, Jan and Dean, the Beach Boys, Larry Williams, Neil Young, the Byrds when they're still the Beefeaters, and the following who have not been featured properly on our show, but definitely have gotten lots of mentions. He's also played in jazz sessions with Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie, and he contributed to blues recordings by freaking B.B. King.
So he's born in 1924 in New Orleans. Whole family, sort of the showbiz types. By the age of five, they got him tap dancing. He's doing vaudeville with his mom and his aunt, and his dad's a musician.
And he grows up and does a stint in the Army. He goes to music school for piano and percussion, and this is the thing with a lot of those Wrecking Crew types. They are trained guns.
Yep.
He had it growing up, but he also studies that art later.
Yeah, it's not a hobby, really. I mean, they are very disciplined in it. And so by the late 40s, Earl's in New Orleans. He's in their scene there, and he becomes this essential component to stuff that becomes very, very important that comes out of that area. Talk a little bit about the names that he works with really early in New Orleans.
Yeah, and the two big ones, easy, are Fats Domino and Little Richard.
Now, Fats is a New Orleans guy, so that makes sense if you know much about Fats. Little Richard, famously not a New Orleans guy. He's from Georgia. So explain this New Orleans connection. I think a lot of people don't know this. We're talking about the different scenes and the different areas. Yeah, there's the L.A. scene that grows. There's a Nashville scene. There is a New Orleans scene.
Yeah, and so that leads us to another character who's very important in the formation of R&B and rock and roll, and that's this guy, Cosimo Matassa.
It's just an amazing name. Cosimo, I don't know.
I met a guy whose name is Cosimo, and I wanted to ask him, like, what the secret of the Illuminati really was. It was just such a weird, I was like, that name was given to you by some parents that knew it was happening. But so, he probably deserves his own episode.
He really does. He's an amazing character.
Only just sort of dug into him recently. So he basically starts a recording studio in the back of his parents' business in New Orleans. And after giving up on being a chemist.
I love this. I love this right turn he takes, right? Or left turn, where he's just like, you know what? Science, nah.
Nah, I'm going to record Little Richard, Fats Domino, Ray Charles, Lee Dorsey, and a whole bunch of other guys. And our guy, Earl Palmer, is Cosimo's guy on the drums in his studio.
Yeah, he's like the session guy in Cosimo's studio. And the Cosimo connection is really important to this story because he starts doing business with a record label in L.A. called Aladdin Records. And Earl will eventually get itchy for something new. Aladdin will offer him a job through this connection. And that's how Earl Palmer gets from New Orleans to Los Angeles, in case you're trying to connect those dots.
Tony Sherman, who's Earl's biographer, explains the larger trend of seasoned musicians from other scenes getting to LA this way. Here's that quote from him. Quote, by the late 1950s, rock was too lucrative to be entrusted to untrained labor.
Remember, these guys are professionals.
Yeah. This is like, think about how like stuff's done with a space bar now. It's like so interesting. It's like, no, they have to be master craftsmen to work on this audio tape. So sorry, back to the quote, which I've completely interrupted. The manufacturer of hit records required a new worker, hip enough to understand the music, disciplined enough to crank out an album a day.
Unbelievable.
Talented musicians streamed into late 50s Los Angeles, sleeping on floors and looking for angles in the studios.
And other members of the Wrecking Crew don't get there as easily as Earl gets there, right? There's a Hal Blaine quote where he says that he and Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell used to sleep, like basically just like get into these terrible places so that they could play on records and make whatever money they could. Here's the quote. I was working at these terrible country dumps in the valley with Glenn and Leon, and we were doing these cheapo sessions. I wonder if you've ever heard this term called twofers, where you did two songs for $25. Sooner or later, some of these songs got released, and then everybody wanted to know who those musicians were, and that's how it all started for us. That's the end of the quote. Yeah.
And there's another reason musicians start going to L.A., but that's because the movie and TV industry, if we put that in perspective when this is happening, this is a big time to be there.
I'd love nothing more on this show than when music history and movie history collide, my two loves. You know that up until the mid-50s, MGM, Warner Brothers, Paramount, all of them, every studio, they had permanent staff orchestras.
Yeah.
Which I forget this fact. But if you were going to make music for a movie, you just went down to the orchestra and they helped whip something up for you, right? Late 50s, this starts to change. Read the opening paragraph from the New York Times, February 20th, 1958.
The International Executive Board of the American Federation of Musicians last night issued strike orders to its local 47, which serves the major film producing studios in Hollywood.
Step right up. Extra. I would really like to get distracted by this, okay? This historical footnote is fascinating, but here's what I'll do instead. I will point you to an excellent podcast/YouTube show that's in the show notes. The creator is named Avelo, and they cover a lot of Hollywood history stuff. And they have a great episode called The Strike That Changed Disney Music. There's a whole section about the 1958 strike in there, so check it out. But for our purposes, this is what you need to know. This strike changed the way that music gets sourced in Hollywood. Basically, the orchestras got cost prohibitive. And so now there is a freelance market.
And I'm glad you brought this up, Ryan, because it gets overlooked in the story. The Wrecking Crew, they do a lot of TV and movie music, too.
Yeah, here's a quote from Earl. When it really dawned on me that I could do this, and I guess he means like make it as a session musician, was when I had to play cartoon music. That's the hardest music I ever had to play. That's easy to determine right off the bat. At one time, I was doing damn near all the cartoons that Warner Brothers made.
Wow.
Yeah. And while, now we laud the Wrecking Crew for being the unsung heroes of rock and roll, for being on Pet Sounds and whatever, right? In real time, back to this idea of like being on something and not understanding the significance, the actual prestigious and better paying work was when you were working for a film or TV studio.
Yeah. And really, if you're just younger than us and you haven't seen old Warner Brothers cartoons, like the fact that these people switch places with these orchestras to do. Because cartoons really did have like crazy music.
I picture that. Picture like an old Tom and Jerry cartoon. Right. I never thought about that music being created.
There's no narrative. So the music itself has to show you the tempo of what the scene is. So the music is totally telling the story.
So a cat chases a mouse and it has to be, it's a really wild thing to think about that you have all these professional guys and women who are called into studios like, okay, now we're going to do this. We're going to, Tom's going to chase Jerry and we got to make it sound like it. Try the beat.
Hey, by the way, super totally unrelated. A friend of mine has been doing voiceover work since college, and he's hit it, man. He's done it. I mean, he's not like he does some pretty high profile stuff, and he's got some pretty high profile clients. But I've never just accidentally heard him in the wild until this weekend.
Oh, really? So,
yeah, and it was this consumer product called Balder Bro, I think, which is like a thing to shave your head. or whatever. What? And it was like, the Baltimore, like whatever. It was so ridiculous. And I sent him a text and I was like, dude, I just heard you. Like, I know it's you. And I told him the product. He goes, yeah, that's me. And he said, where did you see it or hear it? And I had to say, it was during a streaming commercial of a biography about Bobby the Brain Heenan that I was watching on the WWE Peacock network. Like, I had to say that out loud to tell him that I was watching all that shit, because that's where I saw him. Bobby the Brain Heenan, by the way, underrated everything for wrestling, all the stuff. Anyway, that guy, when he wasn't a wrestler, right? He was a manager, but he would get involved into the story, and then he would be in matches, and if he lost, there were always this thing where they would dress him up in a weasel outfit. And the whole crowd would chant, weasel, weasel,
weasel, weasel. Yeah.
That's really, yeah. So anyway, so back to Earl. When you read about Earl, the thing that makes him clear is that he took all this seriously and professionally, right? Maybe more so than we do currently talking about Bobby the Brain Heenan. This is a quote from Earl. Disliking the music was not a problem of mine. Like it or not, I took pride in being able to do this, that, and the other.
But he did have music that he really preferred. And when you research Earl at all, you learn very quickly that his first love is bebop and jazz. We mentioned he ends up on some Count Basie and Dizzy Gillespie. Towards the end, like all the way up till the end of his life in the early 2000s, he's playing in the Earl Palmer Trio. Like, he's playing out in L.A. as an older gentleman in clubs. And when he gets to L.A. initially in the late 50s, he's working in A&R for Aladdin, like I mentioned, but his contract allows him to play with whoever, so he'll take gigs around town and with friends, and he makes all these friends playing jazz. He gets shown around and introduced by Shelly Main.
And Shelly was a drummer and is a jazz giant, and Stan Kenton, Woody Herman, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Shelly played with all of them.
And we haven't talked about, speaking of like the technical things that go along and how different jazz drumming is from rock and roll drumming, right? So we're thinking about, yeah, the technical aspects. We haven't talked about the technical aspects of Earl's playing yet, but it's worth mentioning that he gets a bunch of credit for introducing the backbeat into rock and roll. And that comes via this song that he does with Fats Domino pretty early on called The Fat Man.
Yeah, and so the backbeat for you is a syncopated accentuation on the offbeat. So if you've got a 4-4 rhythm, that means hitting beats 2 and 4. So on the 2, on the 4.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
So now this was a style already being used heavily in a lot of Dixieland music, but Earl takes the concept and spreads it throughout the whole song, and this style becomes the backbone, the DNA of early rock and roll.
Yeah, I like how you're using that term, DNA. Like, it really is part of the cocktail at the very beginning that makes this thing work. And this is another aspect of his heritage and geography. When you read interviews with Earl, and there are some good ones in the show notes, lots of them, archived from old Modern Drummer magazine interviews and stuff, one thing that gets pointed out a lot is that Earl's New Orleans heritage really gets him noticed and sought after, even when he's in and working in L.A. But people are like, oh, that's the guy from New Orleans.
Yeah, and he explains in interviews that he did Little Richard records in L.A. because he had done the early ones in New Orleans. And another guy who he recorded with for most of the fellow's short-lived career, and that is Mr. Sam Cooke.
Here's the quote you're referring to. Sam Cooke was brought also down there, New Orleans, by Bumps Blackwell to record. So we did all his records, and then I did all of Sam's stuff out here because I moved out here until he died. And I think I did everything that he did. I don't remember anything Sam did that I wasn't on. Now, when I read this quote, I found it really interesting that it was, we dug it up, because I don't necessarily think Earl is misremembering. He does seem to have been on the Skins for most of Sam's output, but there is some lore that says Earl almost was not on what would become maybe the most well-known and definitely the most important Sam Cooke record ever made.
Before we jump there, let's do the whole 30,000 feet Sam Cooke for everybody.
All right. Do it. Give us the details.
Real fast. His career was 8 years. So
that's it.
Short.
Wild.
But he had 29 singles that charted in the top 40. as well as 20 singles of the top 10 of the Billboard's Black Singles Chart. Like you, Brian, he was a preacher's kid. Mm-hmm. He started singing in the church at a young age, and then he was leading a gospel group by the time he was in his teens.
Now, he's also notable for being among the first modern Black performers and composers to attend to the business side of his career. So he founded not just a record label, but also a publishing company as an extension of his career as a singer and a composer.
And there was an inordinate amount of tragedy in his life as well, for Pete's sake. Multiple car accidents, one that kills a woman he was married to, another one that kills his driver and then injures Lou Rawls. A child he had in his second marriage drowns in a swimming pool. So just black clouds surround him a lot.
And for most of the 8 years in the music business, Sam is not a controversial or combative figure. He had this unique balance that he was trying to strike. He's headed headlong into the civil rights movement by virtue of existing as a black man in America, but he also had a mostly white audience, and he was known for singing some really benign love songs. And we were talking about his music before we turned the mics on, and I said, you know, honestly, it's so saccharine, a lot of it, until you get to sort of where we're headed. I mean, it's not really something I would want to listen to most of the time.
And you know what's really, you said that, I was really surprised, and it's just, I guess it's one of those things, like, man, I love Sam Cooke. And, like, I love those the real, like, Cupid, rape, draw back your bow. Like, that's exactly what we're talking about.
That's exactly the song I was thinking of, too.
Right. That's exactly what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, it is.
But the lore is that it was Dylan that turned Sam Cooke into openly addressing politics. He hears Blowing in the Wind, and he thinks that if a white guy can do that, he should be doing something to push buttons a little more than what he's doing.
And again, famous lore here, right? October of 63, he has an encounter where he's turned away from staying at a hotel because of the color of his skin. He ends up getting arrested in Louisiana in connection to this, and he channels the anger he feels about it to write his version of a protest song.
And by December, he's playing a new song for friends, one he says will make his preacher father proud. And while it doesn't specifically recount the events of October, there are strong references. Here's the lyrics. I go to the movie and I go downtown and somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
So one of the really interesting tidbits in this story is that Sam, at this point in his career, worked really closely with a guy named Rene Hall, who helped Sam arrange the compositions that would become specific songs. And so Sam writes this tune on a guitar, but to turn it into a full-fledged production, he's got to have somebody who helps him flesh it out. And usually in this process in his writing, he would stay sort of hip to hip with Rene the whole time. And this time he doesn't do that.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't at all. For the first time ever, he tells Rene to give it, quote, the kind of instrumentation and orchestration that it demanded.
And now think about that phrase. That's key to this story. Give it what it demands, what it commands. So Rene understands the burden that he carries now. So he's left on his own to prove himself. And so he creates this very in-depth and heavily instrumentalized score of sorts for this song. It's not just, hey, we're going to add a guitar and a drum and a bass. Like, he's got a full orchestra going. It's a whole thing. Now, Peter Gerlinek, who mostly known for being a biographer of Elvis, correct?
Yeah, Elvis.
He also wrote a definitive biography on Sam Cooke. Read the quote.
Yeah, this is the quote. It was a complex arrangement with something like 17 strings. I think part of him felt, I'm not going to do it if I can't do justice to it. It often gets cited for sounding like a film score and described as being very orchestral.
And we should belabor this point here, but and I already have. When the team shows up to record this, they're taken aback at its complexity musically. And yeah, you remember I quoted Earl as saying that he basically played on all of Sam Cooke's output. It's important to note that in most cases, when Sam played with someone, he was playing for them. Or I'm sorry, when Earl was playing with someone, he was playing with them in the studio. He was not playing with them on tour. He didn't go on tour hardly ever. Other bands would learn the songs for the live show. And so he actually was not planned to play on this one. That day in the studio, they had a drummer named John Boudreau who was scheduled to play.
And we've talked about how influential Earl was in New Orleans. So when he left and moved to LA, he had to be replaced. And the first guy doesn't work out long term, but the second guy hired to be the go-to drummer in New Orleans recording scene is John Rudreau.
So how do they both end up in LA? That's the question I was curious about.
It's worthy of much more discussion, but basically he started a record label artist collective for black artists and moved it to LA to make it work. And one of the features of this group was that they had a de facto house band, and John Boudreau was the drummer of that house band.
And so this house band for AFO, because that's the name of the collective, they get booked for the recording session that day. And so Sam is ready to record the song he has written. But when Renee walks in with the arrangement and hands it to the musicians, John looks at it and he's like, I don't think I can do this. And so he goes to them and says, this arrangement is too difficult. I can't play drums on this.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's accurate, but I read somewhere that John doesn't just say no. He actually won't leave the control room in the studio. He won't get out in front of the mics.
So what the hell are they going to do? Because they need a drummer. They've got a finite amount of time to record this song. And that's when someone realizes that, back to this original premise of being in the right place at the right time, someone's like, hey, Sam, your buddy Earl Palmer is in a session next door.
Yeah, that's right. There's a session going on next door. And who's the drummer? Oh, it's Earl Palmer.
And that's how the drumming of Earl Palmer, a guy who's on a lot of significant records, ends up on maybe one of the most significant records. He's the drumming that's heard on the great foundational early rock and roll, and a song that will go on to define the civil rights movement and continues to be one of the most respected and long-lasting anthems in the Sam Cooke catalog.
It's A Chain's Gonna Come, which for me is a cornerstone song for everything that is America. So that's the most patriotic thing I've ever said.
He pitch hit to save a recording session and ended up playing on one of the most important songs of an entire generation. Unbelievable.
Yeah. This is more from Gerlinek on the significance of this song. Quote, it was less work than any song he'd ever written. It almost scared him that the song, it was almost as if the song were intended for somebody else. He grabbed it out of the air and it came to him whole. Despite the fact that in many ways, it's probably the most complex song that he wrote. It was both singular in the sense that you started out, I was born by the river, but it also told the story both of a generation and of a people.
But the song carries with it even more remarkable history. First, we can timeline this out. The incident in Louisiana that inspires this song happens in October of 63. Sam will show friends the song in December. The recording session is in the winter, and that song will end up on the February 1964 album, Ain't That Good News.
But it's not the lead single.
It's not the lead single. Another case. How many? I feel like we do this every week. We're like, here's one of the best songs ever written. And you know what? Everybody in the room thought it wasn't the best song. There was some other crappy song that was better than it.
A Change Is Gonna Come was a B-side.
To a dance song.
To a dance song. And we haven't even mentioned this here on the show, but at some point, Sam Cooke is managed now at this point by Alan Klein, and some people point the finger directly to Alan Klein for trying to bury the song or for breaking up the fucking Beatles. What a garbage human being he was for being a manager. But in the end of 64, they agree to release A Change Is Gonna Come as a single.
But in December, right as the song is being released as a single, Sam is shot and killed. And you know what? We're not going to step on that because that story is too big to put on the butt end of this episode. So we're going to talk about that on another episode of this show. We've got to dig into what happened with Sam Cooke at that hotel and who might have actually ultimately been responsible for his demise. It's a classic rock and roll bedtime story in the sense that it's a little true crime. It's a lot of rumor and speculation, but we'll have to get into that.
Yeah. And also, if you would like to just join in to my informal poll, Alan Klein, douchebag or the douchiest douchebag of all managers we've ever
There's
talked
only
about.
Two choices. There's only two yeah. choices. It is douchebag. Unbelievable. Well, and I don't want to step on what we're going to get to with Alan Klein next week, but I mean, we already know he like messed up the Beatles really badly. So that alone is enough to besmirch your resume. Before he does that, he does something with this Sam Cooke relationship. And so we're going to get to that. But if you want to jump in the conversation, if you want to talk about your favorite Sam Cooke song, if you want to jump in and make some guesses on what you think we're going to reveal next time we talk, go ahead. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. There's also instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. And you can support this if you're listening to this show and it just you enjoy it. It's helping you get through whatever you're getting through. It would help us if you can throw a few bucks at it. All right. Now, we're not asking for a lot. If you can throw a few bucks a month at it and get some extra bonus content, et cetera, check out our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Murdoch, I got a question for you. Until next time, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.